Or, when you look into a mirror, you see whatever goes into the mirror is reflected in the mirror. So white light goes in, white light comes out. There's no differentiation. So that is like the soul of the human being. Not a perfect mirror, of course. The perfect mirror would be the soul of the manifestation, which is the first created thing of God after the primal will. The soul of the manifestation. And Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá tell us that everything else in creation was created through and by the manifestations of God. So the manifestations actually are the instruments of creation for the rest of creation. Now, exactly how this process goes on is something which will obviously take years and years of study. I'm simply quoting from the writings where it is said that it is by and through the manifestations that God creates the lower levels of humanity, of existence, including ordinary human beings. Okay. So the human reality then has this capacity. This is the essential human capacity, this potentiality, because we have these imperfect mirrors, as we know. But we all have the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Well, let's put it this way. Sometimes I put it this way. The soul, there are two ways in which human beings are the same and one way in which they're different. The first way in which human beings is the same is that all human souls are created from the same substance. Nobody's soul is made out of better stuff than anybody else's stuff. Now, it is not logically necessary that this be the case. In other words, this is God's intention, right? If God had wanted to create some souls out of a different substance than other souls, he could certainly do this, right? God is all powerful, so I mean, we can't say, well, he did it because there was no other way to do it. I mean, it's just not the case, all right? He chose to do it this way. Well, as a matter of fact, the souls of the manifestations are created out of other substance. This we are told, okay? Because they have capacities which our souls don't have. So he could have done it. It is the essential essence, the essential reality of the manifestation is that he reflects perfectly the attributes of God. This is not our essential reality, it is our potential reality, and therefore our souls are created out of other substance than the manifestations. But it's still pretty good stuff, okay? It's still pretty good stuff. And all the souls, of course, we know the hidden word, know ye why we have created you all from the same substance, that no man shall exalt himself above his neighbor, and so on. Okay? So this is the first point of unity. The second point of unity is that every individual human soul has this capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Again, it could have been otherwise. In other words, God could very well have created people in such a way that, you know, you are capable of reflecting certain attributes of God, but not others, and I am capable of reflecting other attributes of God, but not certain that you can, and so on. I mean, that's quite possible. But that's not the case. Over and over again in the writings, we are told that every individual human soul has this capacity. This is its essential reality. This is the definition, even of what the human being is to reflect all of the attributes of God. But then there is a third respect, a third way in which human souls are different. And that is in the proportion in which they reflect these attributes of God. This is the individuality, this is the uniqueness. As Abdu'l-Bahá says in some answered questions, all men have intelligence and will, but men differ in their intellectual and willing and other capacities and so on. So we can think of the individual soul as a prism. Each prism reflects all of the spectrum of colors, right? From the red to the blue end of the spectrum. But each prism has its individuality. It will give more emphasis to certain part of the spectrum than the other. So you might look at light reflected in one prism and see that the red part of the spectrum is enlarged and the blue is condensed. It will all be there, but in different proportions. And the same way another prism might give emphasis to the blue and not the red. So this is the individuality, which, as Atibaha says, is intrinsic, is inherent in our nature, our spiritual nature. It has nothing to do with heredity, and with physical handicaps or mental handicaps or any such thing as that. These are all physical. We know this from the writings. The soul of man, recall, is exalted above and independent of all infirmities of body or mind. Or as Shoghi Effendi said, writing to a mentally ill Baha'i, he said, you should know that these mental illnesses have nothing to do with our spirit or our inner relationship with God. And of course, now science is now proving this, that we're discovering the physical basis of mental illness, which is primarily certain stress-produced metabolic imbalances in the chemistry of the nervous endocrine system. Okay? So a mental illness is no more spiritual than Gordon's sprained ankle. Okay? So this is the human reality. Now, Baha'u'llah says then that this reality is exalted above the whole rest of creation. So, in particular, it's quoted in the peace statement of the House of Justice. You all know the statement of Shoghi Effendi where he says that ideas, laws, and principles are to serve the human being and not the human being to be crucified for the preservation of some doctrine or another, right? He says, it's quoted in the peace statement, you know, so I'm sure we've all used this in teaching the faith, where he says, if certain creeds, if certain principles are outworn, if they have ceased to serve the interests of mankind, then let them be relegated to the limbo of forgotten doctrines, right? With a wave of the hand. For it is the purpose of such principles, laws, and ideas to serve the human being and not the human being to be crucified for the preservation of an ideology. So sometimes, in order to make the point as brutally as I can, in Russia in particular, where the public scene is very grim, I say, take your most cherished ideal, okay, and then go to the metro and find the most degraded looking human being you can find, some drunk sleeping there. I mean, it's always littered full of them. Any metro stop in Moscow or St. Petersburg is full of these people. And I say, you know, find this, you know, person is stinking, lying in his own urine and his own excrement, you know, hardly above the level of a poorly kept animal. And your most cherished ideal is not as valuable as that human being. Okay? Now, this concept is not original with the Baha'i faith, and it is not original with me. The 19th century Russian writers knew this very well. This is the whole theme of Dostoevsky's works, of Tolstoy's works. It's the whole theme of Ibsen's works. The writers of the 19th century knew this. They knew that ideology dehumanizes, because you can justify anything. I mean, let's take quickly the most blatant example, the Inquisition, in which people, Christians, were killed by fellow Christians in the name of Jesus. Now look, I'm sure you've all read the New Testament. Go back and read the New Testament. Read the Gospel of John. Well, what do you see at every page? Love, love, love. Turn the other cheek, right? Pray for your enemies. Do good to those who hate you, all right? The greatest of man is he who will sacrifice his life for another, and so on and so on. Sacrifice, humility, meekness, love, mercy, compassion. Is there one single word of the New Testament that would give any possible sanction to the act of killing another human being? I mean, absolutely not. How much less to killing a fellow believer? Why are we killing these fellow believers? Why? Tell me. Why were people killed in the Inquisition? What? For the preservation of certain doctrines which were held to be sacrosanct. In other words, people were killed in the name of an ideology. So here's a religion whom everybody agrees, Christians and non-Christians all agree that the essence of Jesus' message was love. I mean, when you think of Islam, you think of submission to the will of God. When you think of Buddha, you think of renunciation. When you think of Moses, you think of the law, and so on. When you think of Jesus, you think of love, right? I mean, this is it. Everybody acknowledges. Love is the meaning, the essence of the Christian revelation. And yet, you see the very believers, followers of Jesus, not only killing, I mean, we can talk about the Crusades and all of this sort of stuff, the interreligious wars, but even then you could, you know, maybe justify this to some extent by saying, well, these were non-believers. But here you have with the Inquisition, you have Christians killing fellow Christians in the name of a religion whose meaning is love. Now that's a contradiction. Will you agree that that is a contradiction? That's a pretty big contradiction. So I submit very simply the following thing, that if you can kill in the name of the religion of Jesus Christ, then you can kill in the name of anything. In other words, if there is a social process by which the religion of Jesus Christ could be taken to justify the deliberate killing of another human being, you know, not in the context of war or anything, but just the deliberate killing in the name of ideology of another human being, then you can justify anything, okay? Yeah.
What about the concept of justice?
Well, I'm going to get to that. I'm simply trying to point up, as I said, the most blatant contradiction, okay? Certainly no question of justice is involved in killing people simply because they differed slightly on some obscure doctrine or another. Okay, so that's my only point here. Yes, we're going to talk about the whole relationship between love, power, and justice. But I'm simply trying now to point up the contradiction. Okay, well, so what is religion? I've said what it isn't, that it's not an ideology. What is it? Well, let's say what religion is. I'm going to use my words again since I'm using my words here, but of course there are many quotes. Religion, true religion, since there are so many of the other kind. True religion is a relationship. So that's the logical definition. Let's expand it. True religion is the establishment So in other words, this is the one word answer if you want to say religion is not a product, it is not a social contract, it is not an ideology. Then what is it in one word? It's a relationship, okay? The establishment of a certain kind of relationship. Between God and us, and between ourselves based on the relationship with God. I'm sorry, but I'm running out of time. With God, okay? So I'm saying true religion is a relationship. More particularly, it means the establishment of a certain kind of relationship between God and us, and between ourselves, based on the relationship with God. Now, for various reasons, pedagogical reasons, I have chosen to call this relationship authenticity. So, true religion is the establishment of authentic relationships. That's what it is. You have succeeded, you are a religious person if you are capable of maintaining authentic relationships, and you are an irreligious person if you can't. It has nothing to do with what you believe or don't believe. Has nothing to do with your ideology or anything else. Either you can do it or you can't. And the prophets come to tell us how to do it. Okay? What is the first law of the Kitab-i Aqdas? The first law is prayer. The very first law in the Kitab-i Aqdas is prayer. Allah goes on and on about prayer. What is he telling us? He's telling us that the most fundamental relationship in our existence is the relationship with God, and that prayer is the prime means of attaining this relationship. The next most important relationship is the marriage relationship, because this is the relationship from which society comes forward. So Baha'u'llah takes a lot of times about the parameters of the marriage relationship. He tells us that marriage has to be based on two fundamental pillars, which is reciprocity and fidelity. And he gives us the premises of these. Now you may say, well, fidelity, chastity, all of this, this is really tough. That's true, it is. But what Baha'u'llah is saying, look, you want authentic relationships? Here's how you get them. You don't want it? Don't do it. Okay? Okay? You don't want it? Don't do it. It's not going to hurt God. It's not going to hurt me. Think ye that God is in need of your worship? Know that God is independent of all his creatures. Your allegiance cannot help him, nor does your perversity harm him. He's doing it, the big guy is doing it all for us, okay? All for us. So, to bring this to a kind of a summing up, I maintain that true religion is a relationship. True religion, the purpose of religion is the establishment of authentic relationships between and among human beings. And the basis of this is a certain relationship with God. In other words, in the absence of this relationship with God, you cannot establish authentic relationships between human beings. Now, when we teach the faith and we teach progressive revelation, we say all the religions are from God, but the religions strayed from the path eventually, right? They eventually strayed from the path. And therefore, religion has to be renewed. God sends other prophets because people eventually lost their way. But have we ever thought exactly how it is that previous religions lost their way? Well, the Baha'i writings tell us how they did. They lost their way by transforming themselves into an ideology. As soon as Christianity became an ideology, it ceased to be a religion. Remember what Baha'u'llah says about religion? He says, true religion is the cause of what? Of love, of amity. And he says, anything which is not productive of love and unity is not religion, no matter what it calls itself, right? We know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing. But you know this passage from Baha'u'llah. We quote this often, right? So here Baha'u'llah gives a pragmatic criterion for religion. Religion is that which causes love and unity. Okay? This is the essence of religion. Now, let's make it even clearer. My brother may have been the first to articulate clearly, at least in the framework of the Baha'i dialogue, the notion that the physical world is a vast classroom for learning spiritual principles. Well, let's apply a little of this. As we understand the physical world presently, there are four fundamental forces in physical world. Gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. Now, some of these forces, like the weak nuclear force, are repulsive forces. That is, the weak nuclear force has no attractive form. The weak nuclear force pushes things apart. Certain forces, like electromagnetic force, have both a repulsive and an attractive form. This is positively and negatively charged particles. You know that like charged particles repel each other, and oppositely charged particles attract each other. So electromagnetism has both a positive and a negative form. Gravity and the strong nuclear force, as far as that goes, are examples of purely attractive forces. In other words, gravity in its essence is an attractive force. Now, what does this tell me? This tells me that if I observe in the physical world two things that are being pushed apart, I may not know why they're being pushed apart, but I already know one thing. It isn't gravity that's pushing them apart, right? Because gravity in its essence is an attractive force. I mean, it is inversely proportional to the square of the distance between the centers of the two objects, and directly proportional to their mass. So gravity is an attractive force in its essence. The nature of gravity is to attract. In the same way, Baha'u'llah says, the essence of religion is that it is an attractive force. Religion only creates love and unity. Therefore, whenever we see the opposite of love and unity, we know one thing for sure. We may not know what it is. What is it that's causing this disunity? We may not know. It may take us years of research to find out what in certain instances is causing this antipathy between a husband and a wife, or in a family. The dynamics can be extremely subtle and so on. We may not know, but we already know one thing. It isn't religion that's doing it. Because religion can't do it any more than gravity can push two things apart. Let me just read you this passage, which you all know, which is Abdu'l-Baha's statement about love. Know thou for certain that love is the secret of God's holy dispensation, the manifestation of the all-merciful, the fountain of spiritual outpourings. Love is heaven's kindly light, the Holy Spirit's eternal breath that vivifies the human soul. Love is the cause of God's revelation unto man, the vital bond inherent in accordance with the divine creation and the realities of things. Love is the one means that ensureth true felicity both in this world and the next. Love is the light that guideth in darkness, the living link that uniteth God with man, that assureth the progress of every illumined soul. Love is the most great law that ruleth this mighty and heavenly cycle, the unique power that bindeth together the diverse elements of this material world, the supreme magnetic force that directeth the movements of the spheres and the celestial realms. Love revealeth with unfailing and limitless power the mysteries latent in the universe. Love is the spirit of life unto the adorned body of mankind, the establisher of true civilization in this mortal world, and the shedder of imperishable glory upon every high-aiming race and nation. Well, that's just one of the passages where Allah speaks about love. So true religion is love. God is love, as Jesus already said, okay? God is love. The essence of God is love. Of course, it's also truth, it's also justice. Because on the level of God, these are all the same thing. There's no differentiation on the level of the essence of God. So this authentic relationship that we establish with God is based on love. I mean, that's what it is. It's based on love. Now, in the next session, we'll talk about establishing love, how we establish the authentic relationship, but I want to finish up with this, just the basic notions themselves before we get into more practical things, if you will. So true religion is the means of establishing true love, or what I call authentic relationships. And the essence of love is that it is an attractive force. Another way of defining love is the following. Love is the only relationship which is experienced positively by both participants in the relationship under all circumstances. In other words, love is experienced positively by both the lover and the beloved. In other words, we like to love and we like to receive love. Both the giving of love and the receiving of love are a positive experience. In other words, love is unfailingly produces happiness, right? You cannot love and be unhappy at the same time. And you cannot receive genuine love and be unhappy at the same time. So love produces happiness both in the giver of love and the receiver of love. So it is a mutually positive experience. Love. It is therefore based on a certain kind of symmetry or reciprocity between lover and beloved. We'll talk more about that later on. And we'll talk about justice when we get to that. That's in the how-tos again. Okay. So, love is an attractive force and it's a happy thing. It creates unity and it creates happiness. In fact, I can't think of anything else but love that does create happiness, at least unfailingly happiness, and happiness on everybody's part. So if, for example, I triumph over you, I may feel good about this. This may make me happy, but it's awfully liable to make you unhappy, right? So competition, striving, dominance seeking, may produce a temporary happiness on the part of the winner, but even this is a very unstable kind of happiness, because even when you succeed in a competitive environment, you always have the fear that you're going to lose it, and you know just how how many people are out there ready to take advantage of any weakness that you show, and so on and so on. So even in the winners, the degree of happiness is quite unstable, and on the part of the losers, it's even more unhappy. So striving competition, in other words, as we will see, the pursuit of power, produces ultimately unhappiness. In other words, when it comes down to it, love is the only thing, and it is the thing which makes us happy. Nothing else but love makes us happy. So when we say that true religion, the purpose of true religion is not to promulgate an ideology, but to establish authentic relationships, there's another way of saying that true religion, the purpose of true religion is to make us happy. It's to teach us how to be happy. All right? It's just that simple. Just to teach us how to be happy. If you want to be happy, here's the way to be happy. You don't want to do it? Okay, don't do it. Fine, okay. Don't do it, okay. You say sexual discipline is too hard. Okay, don't do it. Fine, go out. Do whatever you want to do. I'm just telling you, if you want to be happy, here's the way to do it. Okay, you want to have a happy marriage? Here's the way to have a happy marriage. Don't want to do it? Don't do it. Fine. No skin off my back, all right. Okay, so what I'm saying then is that this is the essence of morality, both individual and collective. The nature of morality is the establishment of these authentic relationships, and the establishment within oneself of the capacity to maintain and establish authentic relationships. This is what spiritual development is. This is what self-development is. It is developing your capacity to maintain, initiate and maintain authentic relationships with other human beings. And the proof is very simple. If you are successfully maintaining authentic relationships, then you can do it. And if you aren't, you haven't. So you don't have to worry, you know, go through all sorts of contortions, you know, am I doing it or not? I mean, just look around and just see how the quality of your relationships with people, if you, you know. It's a very tough test, but that's it. I mean, if you're unhappy and other people are unhappy because of your relationship with them, well, you haven't learned how to do it. All right? That's the proof, is that you're not doing it. I mean, it's just that simple, okay? Now, I'm not saying that this is easy to do. Nothing, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, worthwhile is easy. But this is the condition of access to this power, is knowing how to maintain authentic relationships. This is the prime condition that gives us access to this power that I was talking about earlier. Now, one final thing to relate it more to society. I've talked somewhat more on the individual level in this first session. I mentioned that this was the theme of the 19th century writers, at least in Russia and Europe and in North America. It's the theme of the main American novels, like, say, The Scarlet Letter or Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. You know, the heart of Huckleberry Finn, for example, is this relationship which Huckleberry Finn establishes with this black slave, this Negro slave who has escaped. And he feels guilty about this because according to the culture, this is an immoral relationship. I mean, you're not supposed to have a relationship of friendship between a black and a white person and so on. And at one point, Huckleberry Finn says, well, okay, I'll go to hell anyway. He says, maybe I'll go to hell for helping this black man escape. But in other words, Huckleberry Finn relates authentically to this black man. He relates authentically to his soul, to his spiritual potential as a human being. And he knows, whatever else he knows that this is authentic and that it's certainly not authentic for such a human being to be held in involuntary servitude. And so he draws the conclusion, my moral duty is to help this person. And so at one point there's this soliloquy when Huckleberry Finn talks to himself about, well, you know, he internalizes this whole dialogue of the society that, you know, this is the wrong thing to do, that slaves are the legal property of their masters, and that to help them is illegal, and so on, and therefore immoral. And he thinks about all the condemnation that his act would bring upon him if it were known by others. And he says, maybe he'll even go to hell. But then he says, well, I'll just have to go to hell then, if that's the consequence, because I can't do anything else. So this is a perfect example of a human being establishing authentic relationship independently of the parameters of the society. Okay? Well, Dostoevsky was brilliant in portraying this. This is the theme of Dostoevsky's novels. But the conclusion of all of these writers and philosophers who were essentially humanists was the following. The only thing worth having in life is authentic relationships. But man cannot on his own establish authentic relationships. He can't do it. Therefore, the human being is condemned to seek that which he cannot have. And this is the human condition. So this is the tragic, dark aspect, the conclusion to which the great existentialist philosophers of the 19th century came to. This is Dostoevsky to a T, this is Kierkegaard, and so on. In other words, nothing else but authenticity is worth having. Everything else is a sham. But there is some point at which every human being will betray. Okay, in other words, this is what Dostoevsky does. Rather than focusing on one character like Huckleberry Finn, he has a whole panoply of characters, right? From the most idealistic to the most cruel and sadistic. And you have all in this pot of all of these characters, they're all interacting. You have Alyosha, who visits the prostitute and so on, and he doesn't have sexual relationships with her. He tries to establish a philosophical discourse with her and so on and this, and she says, you know, aren't you attracted to me, and so on. So she feels dehumanized or devalued in her value system because she feels that she's not sexually attracted to this man who wants to talk philosophy with her, and so on and so on. So you have all of these, but the point is that ultimately everyone betrays. In other words, if you look at Dostoevsky's novel, ultimately at some point everybody betrays. And therefore, man craves in his essence authentic relationships, but he cannot sustain them because he's imperfect. And this then is the human condition. And this gives rise in the Russian version to this fatalism, which has been noticed and remarked upon so often in the Russian character, that the essential meaning of life is to endure this condition with dignity. In other words, you can't change it. Man is imperfect, and man craves authenticity. These are unchangeable things. You can't change either one of those. Man cannot renounce his thirst for authenticity, nor can he achieve it because he's imperfect, and therefore he can only resign himself to enduring this incredible tension with the greatest possible dignity. So that was one cultural solution to this dilemma. The other cultural solution is the one we chose in North America. And that is the solution that says, okay, you can't have authentic relationships. So what are you going to do? You're going to create the best possible substitute, virtual reality. And so this is what our culture is. It is a vast machine for producing illusions that are substitutes for authentic relationships. That's exactly what our society is. And if you're going to get through the next 4 years as Baha'is, you better start right now thinking about the ways in which you are personally influenced by this society, because believe me, you are, whether you think you are or not, or whether you like it or not. Okay? So in other words, what has the United States gendered? Well, it has engendered the movie industry. It has engendered the illusion of unlimited growth and development through this profligate wasting and spending of natural resources. As soon as any new technology comes along, it is pushed to its ultimate, and we have computers, and now we have the World Wide Web and all of this, and we're now people, I mean, already for the last 20 years, the whole young generation has been raised by TV sets. I mean, they don't have parents anymore. They're raised by the TV set, right? I mean, just, you know, go into any home and look, the kids there, okay? And now they're being raised by computers. And so people no longer relate to each other. And so their inner lives are totally empty. I mean, they have totally lost the capacity for authentic relationship to such an extent that the only thing that they can do is to give importance to the trivial. In other words, since there is no authenticity anyway, there's no hint of authenticity, then what you try to do is, since you're living totally immersed in the banal, then you have to somehow give importance to the banal. And how do you do this? Well, just turn on any TV talk show, and you'll see people discoursing infinitely about their totally empty, meaningless lives.